In his new book, The Frackers, journalist Gregory Zuckerman tells us the backstory. Far from the limelight, Aubrey McClendon, Harold Hamm, Mark Papa, and other wildcatters were determined to tap massive deposits of oil and gas that Exxon, Chevron, and other giants had dismissed as a waste of time. By experimenting with hydraulic fracturing through extremely dense shale, a process now known as fracking, the wildcatters started a revolution. In just a few years, they looked to relieve America's dependence on imported energy, they triggered a global environmental controversy, and they made and lost astonishing fortunes. Gregory Zuckerman joins us on the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, great to be here.
Again, the title of the book is The Frackers. It is published by Portfolio. What led you to these men and what they wanted to do?
So I wanted to take a step back. We all know that as a nation, we're producing more energy than in years. We've gone from a desperate situation where we were running out of oil and gas, and now we're actually going to be exporting gas, and we're producing more oil than in many years. We're actually close to, on the road towards energy independence or security. But I wanted to kind of figure out how it happened, who the people are behind it, what the drama was, and I found some interesting characters who played important roles as pioneers.
When it comes to the pioneers, when did this all start brewing?
So in the late 90s, a guy named George Mitchell was pushing his troops to figure out how to tap this layer of shale in Texas. And they finally figured out after 17 long years of frustration. In 1998, there's a guy named Nick Steinberger, a young guy working for Mitchell, and he sort of had a breakthrough moment I write about in the book. But for a while, people kind of said, okay, Mitchell, you got it right in that area in Texas, but everyone knows that you can't produce much oil or gas from shale. It's like this very compressed, difficult rock. It looks a little bit like tombstone. And but just around 2008 or so, people finally started making progress. And again, it wasn't sort of the experts. It was these wildcatters you wouldn't have expected. And I think it got lost in the shuffle with the financial meltdown that we were actually having this remarkable success in our nation's fields.
And when we talk about what they're doing, how did they know that the oil and gas was actually down there?
Everyone knows, geologists in school have tested it, and they knew that it was packed with oil and gas. The problem was, it's really far down there, and again, it's really compressed, difficult rock. So we're talking some of these layers are as much as almost 14,000 feet below the surface, really hard rock, and it was a lot of trial and error. You know, people say America doesn't innovate anymore, but these guys figured out how to drill horizontally. Over years, we finally got that right. Drilling down, these are very long but very narrow shale layers, and you needed to go horizontally. And then they figured out the right way to fracture the rock, to hydraulic fracture or frack the rock, and then finally had that kind of breakthrough.
So the question has always been, yes, it's down there, but is it worth going for? In the sense, is the cost of getting it going
exactly
to exceed the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into getting it?
Exactly. And it helped that natural gas prices and oil prices were sky high when these guys made the real big push. So there was a lot of incentive, market incentive there. Market cues helped them.
So basically, this is, we're looking at companies in Texas and Oklahoma who had their eye on this while the giants, the big guys, stepped away.
Yeah, the crazy thing is Exxon, their corporate headquarters in Irving, Texas, are literally right above this Barnett Shale. So in other words, they were sitting on this stuff, and yet they were going anywhere but America. They were Africa, Asia, offshore, everybody, all the big guys. They all sort of gave up on trying to tap, or didn't even think they should work on trying to tap this shale. So it took sort of these, I call them outsiders, or just sort of overlooked guys in the business to figure it out.
When they set out, what did they need to do to put the infrastructure together to make this happen?
Well, it was everything from finding the right mix of chemicals and water and sand to fracture this thing. There was also just sort of the issue, like I said, of horizontal drilling. It took a while. There are different stages of fracking. So you drill horizontally, but how far along do you do it? Where do you frack it? You know, a lot of it's trial and error, and guys, making mistakes and almost getting fired and get screamed at by their bosses. And that's sort of what I write about in the book.
When it comes to the actual technology, I mean, you point out in the book that this has been tried in one shape or form going back into the mid 1800s.
Yeah, listen, we've been fracking forever in this country. I don't want to exaggerate. The 50s, we were starting to do fracking, but we didn't do much in the way of shale. So we were fracking elsewhere, again, just sort of fracturing the rock. But shale was this sort of fool's gold. People trying it kind of gave up and lost their jobs and their careers and their reputations until these guys finally figured it out.
So let us talk a little bit about the figuring it out part. When it comes to George Mitchell and Mitchell Energy, they were the ones ultimately that figured out this that using this water-based method that kind of started things going, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but the breakthrough really came from a mistake. It's ironic and unexpected, but what happened was one day they were pumping this mixture that everyone in the whole industry used of chemicals, water, and sand down into the shale, and they backsended. It wasn't them; their contractor put too much water in the mix, and Steinsberger noticed that, and it was still getting pretty good results, nothing amazing, but pretty good results. And he said, "Well, hold on a second, maybe we should go down this path of using too much more water than we had expected." And they got to the point where they're using something that's pretty much 99.5% water. There's a lot of water being used, both for good and for bad, you could say, and a little bit of chemicals and sand. And, you know, they tweaked it and they played with it. They finally figured it out.
The men that you write about, that I mentioned in the introduction, Aubrey McClendon, Harold Hamm, Mark Papa, what do these men have in common?
A remarkable amount of confidence, stubborn. They're stubborn guys. They often come from backgrounds, from difficult backgrounds, difficult starts to their lives. Tom Ward, who I write about and was one of the founders of Chesapeake. His father was an alcoholic. His grandfather was an alcoholic. Grew up in a little town in Oklahoma. Harold Hamm grew up in a smaller town and much poorer in Oklahoma. He grew up so poor that he couldn't start school each year until around Christmas time because he was needed in the fields. His parents were sharecroppers and they were picking cotton and such, and he needed to help them. And by time Christmas time rolled around, it was a little cold, so he was allowed to go to school. And he didn't go to college, didn't take a kind of geology courses. He took a few on the side when he got older. And yet he's the guy that owns the most oil in this whole country right now. He's worth $14 billion. He's worth more than the estate of Steve Jobs. He's unfortunately going through a divorce right now, but his wife is going to walk away with more money than Oprah. So it's a real rags-to-riches story.
So meanwhile, the environmental question marks remain, and you address it a bit in the book, not a lot, but as far as what we're dealing with here and how much further we should go in researching this and knowing for sure what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, so I put a lot of work into this, and the way I come down on the question is that the energy industry really overstates its case as to the fact that fracking is really, really safe, and the activists overstate their case as to saying that it poisons. So there's somewhere in the middle, and you know, I'm sort of a journalist, so maybe it's cliche of me to come to that realization. But the energy industry really has made mistake after mistake from the get-go. They often poorly sealed wells. There are surface spills. There are leaks. Chemicals have gotten into drinking water, and you know, if you are in that neighborhood where there's a lot of drilling, I've met with all kinds of people. A lot of people don't like the noise and the dirt, etc. That said, the activists also overstate their case. It's really, if you talk to scientists, it's really unlikely that the chemicals are going to go from as much as 14,000 feet below the surface all the way up to the aquifers, which are between 400 and 1,200 feet. Also, this whole issue of methane getting into the water and turning on the faucet and it blowing up is overstated. If you talk to, you know, I talk to old timers in places like Dimmick, and they say they've been doing that. They've been lighting their faucets on fire for decades and decades. And there are three towns in this country called Burning Springs. Burning Springs are the name of three different towns because it's always been that, like that. Methane naturally comes up, so it's nothing to do with the fracking process. My argument is that fracking can be done properly and safely, but it isn't necessarily right now all the time. So we want to work with the frackers as opposed to condemn them and make sure they do it properly.
So what do we do as far as regulation? What do we do as far as the environmental impacts, which many are very, very real, and also the issue of just the fact that here again we're spending we're giving people a lot of money for their land, and you do write in the book that there's a lot of fortunes lost here as well as fortunes being made.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are people like Aubrey McClendon I write about who were worth $3 billion and they kind of blew it because of how much gas they themselves and others produced, and sent prices of collapsing. But it's also the case that in neighborhoods, in towns, you've got people that have done well and their neighbors haven't done well. Either they didn't own their own land rights, or they sold too cheaply, or they just didn't get an offer. And it's really created some discord within these communities, which is really sad. In the same town, little towns in Pennsylvania and other places I visited, you've got people that are really thrilled that the producers have come and they've been able to save their homes and their farms, and other people are outraged and their whole way of life has been disturbed, and it's a beautiful part of the country and they're upset about it. And I'm not sure what you can do about some of that kind of stuff. I mean, unfortunately, that may be the nature of things, but there are things you can do. We are recycling more of the water. They should be kind of more pressure to encourage people to do that. We're flaring much too much. We're wasting a lot of natural gas. You go to North Dakota, and it's kind of beautiful at night, but it's sad that we're wasting all this natural gas and burning it off into the environment. There are worse things you could do with it, but that's not so good. There are all kinds of other things you could take. You can make sure there are more rules about sealing wells, the casing. So there's a group called the EDF, Environmental Defense Fund, that works with the producers and tries to push them and pressure them. And I subscribe to that view rather than condemn them.
The name of the book is The Frackers by Gregory Zuckerman. It's published by Portfolio. Gregory, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, great to be here.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.